by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make dab in the middle of it. Grass make dab in the middle. We are grass make dab in the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Boy, I tell you what, this last week has been a very eventful week. Thank goodness we're on the road, hopefully, to settling the Syrian attack, because you say the Syrian crisis, or we're hopefully on the road to solving that. John Kerry is over in Geneva, Switzerland, meeting his counterpart, the Russian foreign minister. And they made an opening statement recently. And so they're negotiating. But what's important to remember is that right out of the, at the very beginning of this negotiation, I believe the American stance, one of the items necessary for agreement is that they will not give up their right to the use of force in case this extraction and removal of the chemical weapons from Syria is not successful. So the American position is that if the chemical weapons are not removed in a proper and a successful and verifiable manner, the United States reserves the right to continue to use that as an option. Now, the Russians representing the Syrian position have totally the opposite, view on that particular item and that position. And the Russians say you're going to have to give up this attack mode, United States, for us to begin to have an agreement here. We're going to have later on, beginning at the second hour, Ray McGovern is going to come in with us from his home in Virginia, and he's going to brief us and bring us up to date on Syria and his view. And Ray and I talked on Friday a little bit yesterday, and we have an hour of uninterrupted interview. Our new format now is 2 full hours of uninterrupted advertising or commercials. That gives us approximately, with an entering and exiting time a little bit, a couple of minutes, that gives us approximately 58 minutes of talk time. So we're beginning to make full use of that. And this Syrian situation, there were two major attacks recently this year, one in March and one recently in August, on August 21st. The one in March, the Russians have evidence in a 100-page report they've turned into the UN stating they believe it was rebels that did the attack. We have certain characteristics that are important to remember about what they call kitchen-grade sarin. Okay, we believe that sarin gas was used in both attacks. Now, there's a weapons grade, which is made by military-industrial complexes. And then there's what they call a kitchen grade, sort of kitchen chemistry is what we used to say when we were attending the lower level chemistry classes at the university. But anyway, you've got a kitchen grade sarin, and then you've got a weapons grade sarin. The difference, what some of the experts are stating in articles and so forth, and pronouncements and opinions and so forth, is that the weapons grade sarin sticks to the clothing. so that when first responders get in and try to make an assessment after a gas attack, a chemical attack, they can die from touching the people's clothing, outside clothing, because the weapons grade will stick to the clothing. They say, the experts say, that the kitchen grade, okay, sarin, does not have that same characteristic. It will not stick, and it dissipates off of the clothing. And the reports are that the first responders that first responded to this event, which was on the outskirts of Damascus, and it was northeast area there outside of Damascus, did not die or did not suffer any consequences. So they're saying the first responders, there's no reports of them having problems or death from the first responders, which would indicate that it could be a lower grade, kitchen grade sarin is what some experts are telling us. Now we get back to the negotiations in Geneva. There's the rebel faction, which is tending, by recent reports, to be more radical, and it's being radicalized by the more extreme jihadist elements that are moving in. These recent reports have said that the CIA is in there providing weapons to the rebels. So if it's true that the jihadist elements or the rebels are being more radicalized by the jihadist elements and their more extreme rebel fighters, then they're going to push out the moderates. And in doing that, it's going to be a much more difficult situation to try to negotiate. The rebels do not want a settlement. They want a position where they can continue to fight and put the Syrian government in a bad light. Assad recently was, Charlie Rose interviewed Assad recently, and Assad said on the program explicitly that he did not order any attack, chemical attack, in Damascus or anywhere else. There were intercepts that the president and the national security and his staff are bandering about. They will not provide us the script. And I'm going to ask Ray McGovern during the second hour. I'm going to put the question to him, and I think he'll be forthcoming, of course, on his own on that, in that particular situation. And I can almost predict what he's going to say, but I don't want to jump the gun here and speak for him. But anyway, they are not providing us a script of that intercept, a written script, so that we can see it for ourselves. The means and methods of interception, and I spent 3 years in the Army Security Agency, so I'm speaking from a position of experience here. And the means and methods of the equipment used and the techniques used are the most secret part of any operation where you're captivating, where you're capturing, and you're intercepting communications. So the Obama administration went ahead and announced this. But so they've already revealed that we have the capability to intercept some of the top communications links and so forth. So I'm sure that they closed down some of those. So even announcing that, the Obama administration, even making an announcement that we had captured or intercepted some of their inside military communications would greatly reduce our capability in the future. My experience in the Army Security Agency, which worked directly under the NSA, was that we never revealed our means and methods because that was some of the most secret, the more closely guarded secrets of anything that we did. And then also, you never revealed your intelligence to the enemy or the target, because then they would know immediately that you had intercepted and were listening into their, or what we call reading their mail. There were experiences of past events that the ASA was formed before the NSA. And the ASA was intercepting traffic going into a spy network, which was called later the Rosenberg Network, spy network, and they were operating out of New Mexico, and they were stealing some of our atomic hydrogen bomb secrets. And we were able to break some of their messages because they were using a one-pad system and they were using a key on both ends more than once. When you're using one-pad systems, you're not supposed to use the key but once and then cast it off and then secure another key on both ends. And then, but only use that for that one message. If you use it for successive or several messages, you can start comparing the messages and then break some of those messages that way. The Army Security Agency on the Rosenberg intercepts, which were called the Venona intercepts, which are part of the downloadable intercepts and data from the NSA site today, called the Venona, were like that. They had used a one-pad system, and they'd used a key on both ends more than once. And so we were able to identify some of the players and some of the spies and begin to put piece together. They were using, you know, pseudonames and nom de guerre, you know what I mean? So it was all assumed names that they were using. But we were able to identify them much later and tie those assumed names to their the real names that they were. This is a very ticklish, this negotiation in Geneva. Can they get off this first hurdle or get over that hurdle of demanding, the U.S. is demanding we have the right to use force if this chemical, you know, extraction or removal is not successful. The Russians are saying, you got to drop that demand right now. Well, I mean, why doesn't the United States say, okay, and for this negotiation, we'll drop that demand? But at any time, they can bring it back up again. You know, they'll just start another, you know what I mean, another congressional type of consulting with the Congress. A little over a year ago, Obama drew that red line, and he said it specifically that he was drawing a red line. It had to do with the use of chemical weapons by the Syrian government. And he said if they get over that line, if they, you know, pass, violate that line, then we're going to go in. We're going to do something serious. And then he backtracked on that recently and said, well, the international community has drawn that red line. So he's waffling. This is the problem with Obama. He's a weak president, and he waffles. He goes back and forth. Seems like the one that's providing the greatest pressure on him is the one that gets the best results from him. So we're still at a standstill. We don't have a lot of information yet. We're not going to get a lot until later with the negotiations in Geneva. One interesting thing just recently was that Japan was awarded the 2020 Summer Olympics. Are you kidding me? In Tokyo. And the Japanese are saying, oh, the Fukushima problem with the radiation is going to be solved. We've got 7 years to do it, so all we can do that in 7 years. That's what they're saying. I'm not so sure about that. And there's great controversy whether what they can do or not on that, and I'm not sure that they can solve it. There was a cartoon that appeared in a French public newspaper that showed that okay, here we go now. Let me get back to this a second. The contamination recently. An article just was added here recently, just Wednesday, and it was in The Guardian. And let me lay some groundwork here on this Fukushima problem first. It says now exposure to emissions would be fatal within hours, say Japanese authorities, as race to build frozen wall begins. They're going to put some kind of a frozen wall down. Here it says the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant has radiation leaks strong enough to deliver a fatal dose within hours. Japanese authorities have revealed as the government prepares to step in to help contain leaks of highly toxic water at the site. Okay, they've miller servants 1800 an hour near a storage tank. Well, if you start really digging down into the different articles, okay, they started out with a dozen storage tanks, and right now, believe it or not, there's 1,000 storage tanks around that complex that they're storing this highly radioactive water. It has very, very toxic elements in it that cannot be released into the ocean. So all they're doing is taking water, circulating it down through the remaining reactors, which are hotter than hell, Hades, and then piping it back up to these storage tanks. But there's 1,000 storage tanks. Okay, it says currently, this article, regarding 400 tons of groundwater are streaming into the reactor basements from the hills around the plant each day. The water is pumped out and held in about 1,000 storage tanks. The tanks contain 330 tons of water with varying levels of toxicity. Okay, and now we're saying here at the end of this article, it says that Shinzo Abe said he understood the growing concern at home and overseas about the state of the plant, and taking the lead in to solve the problem. To do that, we are resolutely implementing drastic measures. Okay, Abe goes on to say, we will make Tokyo's final. Okay, he says, and this is before they actually won this article, before it was announced that they won the deal. He said, I will be explaining to the IOC, the Olympic Committee, International Olympic Committee, that in 7 years' time, 2020, it will not be a problem at all. So evidently, he was successful in explaining that, yeah, we can do it, and we can handle it. And so they went for it, see, and they went ahead and did it, and went for it. And this is how crazy it's getting today. The two cities vying for the Olympic Games was Istanbul and Tokyo. And Tokyo, Japan, won between the two. So there you go, folks. Let's give it to the place where there's rising radiation. And that was a bad, bad decision. In fact, Charlotte and I were on top of this Fukushima disaster from the beginning. We were interviewing that next evening the director of the tsunami center in Hawaii, and then we also interviewed a couple of Air Force officers, one in the northern part of Japan, and then one in the Air Force base right there out of Tokyo. There was a radiation assessment team that we interviewed on the second. The third interview I arranged with the commandant of the wing out there out of Hawaii for that whole area, and he stood me up. So I was trying to, he did a Herculean task in Sendai in clearing the runways there and getting help in early on after this disaster had occurred. But for some reason, maybe there was a mix up on the time or something, we had his public relations man set it up, and it was verified and confirmed for sure. But for some reason, I don't know for sure what happened. But the Fukushima is dangerous, dangerous, dangerous. It's not dissipating. It is still, they're still having problems there. The people in the surrounding areas are being misled. And one doctor over there said, just smile will keep you from getting the radiation. Just smiling, you know. No, I mean, the Japanese people are good-hearted people. They're easily regimented, and they believe in their authority figures. The authority figures in this case have purposely, in my opinion, and intentionally lied to keep a panic from ensuing within the population of Japan. Maybe this was a smart thing to do, but in my way of thinking, immediately after, within a day or two, I started expressing that the solution, in my opinion, should have come from the sea, not the land side. The land side was all messed up, the roads, debris, people trying to stream out of those villages and cities that were devastated by the quake and so forth. And so they should have brought big freighters in, or big ships in, and tied them up there to the docks with big generators, and started jerry-rigging pumps and water through those reactors and so forth, and they might have saved it. But they went into meltdown pretty quick. Within 24 to 48 hours, they started melting down. And we had predicted that. We put up, if you go back to our site during that period, within days we had on our site a prediction within a week from that Saturday that we first interviewed the tsunami to the next Saturday, we were pulling out articles being written that they had already gone into a meltdown mode. So we had that tacked down pretty good. Want to say something here about the conspiratorial. By the way, yesterday, okay? Yesterday was Friday the 13th. Okay. Now, this has come to be an unlucky day, okay? A superstitious type of thing. But on Friday the 13th, 1307, the King of France, okay, moved against, okay, King Philip IV of France, okay, raided and arrested the Knights Templar in France. And that's why, by legend, Friday the 13th has become an unlucky day, for sure, for the Knights Templar. And they were, judged to be, guilty of crimes of against the church, and practicing all kinds of esoteric and very dreadful ceremonies and initiations and so forth. So later, this John Robison, okay, would write extensively about the Illuminati, which occurred later than this, 1776, July 4th, May 1st, 1776, was the kickoff at Ingolstadt, University of Ingolstadt in Bavaria. And it seems like when you're talking about Germany, okay, some of the finest minds and the greatest inventions of our day, of the last few centuries, have come out of Germany. But also, contrarian things have been the worst occults and secret societies and draconian, monopolistic, dictatorial. We had the Hitlers, and we had all these militaristic. Also, we had, according to Charlotte Iserby, which was very interesting, she wrote The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America. But what she also said in there, in her book, was that the Prussians, after having been defeated by Napoleon, that after they pushed him back out and he was defeated at Waterloo by the British, then they regrouped, the Prussians did, and they established national education systems. Well, these national education systems were created to educate their population, okay, into creating, into structuring and creating a citizen soldier, defender of the realm of the country, one that was very loyal and very patriotic to the Prussian system that could defend Prussia from its enemies. But what the real essence of it was the wealthy used these poor farmers and these poor peasants and common men to throw their lives away for the defending of their wealth. That's what it was really about. And when you start coming down to it, they made it mandatory so all young people would begin a conditioning process and be conditioned into love of country, defense the country, so forth. And you see that very strongly in the German psyche, where you've got the World War I and the World War II and so forth, fighting for Germany, Deutschland über alles, And I've been standing on those steps in Nuremberg myself and got a taste of what it might have been when Hitler was there standing there giving those speeches. And you had a very large, you could say, a field that was converted into a reviewing stand. On one side was at least 500 or 600 feet long. A friend of mine, he landed a small light plane down in front of those columns because there was a paved area in there of stones and so forth. And he actually, after World War II, he was over there in the Nuremberg area. And this thing was so large, this was all Soldatenfeld, soldiers' field. It was so large that he was able to land in front of these Roman columns, which stretched for hundreds of yards, hundreds of meters long, and then take off from that same area. It was like a little landing field there, see? So the Germans, they played up the pageantry, and Hitler could mesmerize the crowds with his long speeches and the colors and the German yearning for the homeland, der Vaterland, the fatherland, you know what I mean? The love of Germany, and so they were conditioned from infancy to adulthood to lay down their lives. And that's basically the problem with sending men away. Young men do not know the horrors of war yet, and so they go into war with idealistic ideas about defending and standing up for America in this sense, in our in our country, and standing up for liberties and freedom. And they don't know that some of the worst people in the world are running our government. Some of the biggest crooks, some of the most scandalous and corrupt individuals, that you could ever, describe, are running the government, controlling the government, and are out there just using these young men, just throwing them into battle. But it's about money and power and oil, things like that. When you look at Brzezinski's The Grand Chessboard, if you've read that before, he talks about, there's a couple of things to read out there, if you're interested in this, a Bernard Lewis plan, and go into YouTube and pull up some of Bernard Lewis's speeches on YouTube, and you'll begin to see what I'm saying is that Bernard Lewis is just an intellectual, bar none, one of the best, okay? So his arguments are very fine arguments and very finely and very sharply calculated to create a very radical Muslim, a very radical jihadist that must be dealt with. And the way to deal with these people is to take out their nation states and take down the Arab states by balkanizing their countries. Now that is actually Wesley Clark in 2003 was at the Pentagon. And he gives us evidence that the plan was that he was shown a plan by a fellow general that this is what we've been told to do, is take down these seven countries. And basically that's what is unfolding in this being created, this uproar and this upheaval and this chaos is taking place in these Muslim countries. Before this uprising started, in the 70s, the Arab League came together. They began to organize armies, and this became a very, very dangerous threat to Israel. Israel, the whole time, has used American, very, very well-intentioned Americans to do their bidding, and some of the angles that the Israelis have used on Americans is the Christian angle or the Christian view, say, perspective. And so they can make, overtures, you could say, to the Christian community through Jesus and the New Testament and things like that. They've developed a very, very powerful, a very lucrative tourist industry over there by bringing a lot of church groups over. So this is not something to be taken light, and it's a major, they have these kibbutzes, the labor Zionists. I've been able to to develop a much better and a much more objective view of Israel, the United States, and the UK and things like this over the last few years, because I'm not hating any of these people. And one of my views, and I want to make this perfectly clear, when I'm talking about Israel, okay, I'm not talking about the good citizens, the Jews and Arabs and whatever, the Palestinians of the area, or especially the Jews. I'm not putting them down at all. The leadership is rotten in Israel, and it's rotten in the United States. That's what I'm saying. And they're working together. The leadership in England and Europe, they're all rotten to the core. They're all working together to create a slave state, a scientific dictatorship. And whether you're in Israel or you're in the United States or in the UK or the European Union, we're all being subjected and being used by certain mechanisms of mind wash and control, economic control, see. So that's what I'm saying, is that the good people that want to do the right thing and to treat Americans right, and the good Americans that want to treat the Jewish population right, whether they're here or in Israel, we have a very contentious leadership, and very corrupt and very crooked and very criminal leadership, both in Israel and in this country, and in England and these other places. I always say the scum rises to the top of a pond, because the scum, in this case, are the very powerful sociopathical and psychopathically driven individuals. And it's men, and I've said this before about the man problem. Last week, we had Catherine Berry on here, and she said it from a little different angle, see. But men do not see this in their cult and their condition in our culture. They're conditioned from childhood to pick up guns and to fight and to go to war, and they make war and they fight and stuff like that. It's not that we should not defend ourselves. In fact, Mahatma Gandhi, he actually expressed the view one time that violence that was necessary, or you know what I mean, he felt like was warranted, I guess it would be the word. He felt like the violence warranted to use violence to protect one's family was warranted, because your family is that key organizing group in any society. It's a founding unit of any society. It's the love between man and woman and husband and wife. It's that love for one another, and then the raising of the children, the love for the children, that cements that family unit together. We're not going to have the same by turning our children over to some kind of governmental organization. You're not going to have it. It's not going to work. There's not love there. There's abuse there. And all of these child care things, whether it's this state or other state, there's been scandals in this area where they had rape rooms and all these different people came in. The country is in a sad shape. But we've got to wake up to some of the real problems. Oh, before I forget, and I should have announced this at the very top of the program. This program tonight, I want to dedicate to Robert Bowman, Colonel Robert Bowman. And he's one of the finest people that I've ever met, and Charlotte would agree with me, is that he was a founder, you could say, and first organizer of the Star Wars program. And he eventually reached a point or an opinion that it was not actually, it was billed as a defensive, okay? You could say defensive shield, okay, for America. But he began to understand that the operation and the Star Wars system had built into it some very, very aggressive, okay, and very, very, powerful, you could say aggressive attack systems built into it. He never talked about this much, and he died just recently. He died on the 22nd of August, and we want to dedicate this program, and we want to bring out to the public that Robert M. Bowman was just a fine person, okay? He was born in 1934. He flew 101 combat missions. He received a Ph.D. in aeronautics and nuclear engineering from the California Institute of Technology. Okay, and it goes on and on. After he retired, he became very active, an activist. And one of the things that this man stood up for, which was positively one of the great, that made him great in my eyes, to be in the highest position that he was in and to stand up for 9/11 truth, which he did very forcefully and very good, with good evidence and well spoken. Well, take a man that's got, you know, degrees in aeronautics and everything else and nuclear engineering and put him up before a crowd, and he's standing there and exposing that 9/11 was an inside job. This is what made him great. He didn't back off from it. He spoke in a calm, concerted manner. He had his thoughts organized. He was a fine person. When he came to Austin several years ago, Charlotte and I made arrangements to find a place. He and his wife had been married over 50 years. They were traveling in a motor home. We found a place he could hook up, get free electricity. It was very close to Brave New Books, is where he spoke at that night. And we made sure that we could take him. Charlotte Littlefield picked him up in her car and drove him down there and picked him up from the Brave New Books and drove him back to the motor home. They didn't have to disconnect anything. But he's a fine person. He lived a very upright and outstanding life. And we want to make sure that we dedicate this program tonight to his memory. People come and go, and we hardly remember them sometimes, and we just need to put forth that this guy was, he's one of the best. Robert Bowman, we're going to miss you. And we want to offer our condolences to his family. We should have done this earlier, after his, closer to his passing, but we got caught up like everybody gets, just caught up in business and making deals and recording deals and so forth. Okay. In addition, because Robert Bowman was a quite a spokesman, an outstanding spokesman for 9/11 Truth, stating it was an inside job in his opinion. Recently, we've had an Italian member of Parliament state the same thing publicly in Parliament and make a statement. Bernini, an MP for the Five Star Movement, was speaking in Parliament this last Wednesday. He said that the official version of the event has proved wrong from every point of view. It's clearly false, and by now the world has realized. Bernini believes that the account is it was a conspiracy that was put together to create this 9/11 attack. And he was recently elected to the Parliament, member of Parliament, and he represents what they call the Five Star Movement. So I went to the Wikipedia to look that up. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that, as much as I know, reading out of Wikipedia. It does provide a very, very good source to instantly get stuff while you're online. And we're live broadcasting tonight from Austin, Texas. It's September 14th, 2013. And we welcome you to our program. Our next hour, live from Virginia, will be Ray McGovern. And he's going to give us, we've got one full hour there to talk straight from beginning to end. And he's going to give us a little background that he doesn't normally have time on some other programs to give the really background that he wants to give. We talked about it Friday the 13th, and we sort of laid out the organization of the program. And he's got a mind like a steel trap. He was on the analyst side, not the operations side. So he believes that that was one of the key faults of organizing, the initial organizing of the CIA, with not only an analyst side, an intelligence gathering and analysis side, but they went in with operations also. So it distorts sometimes the ability to make objective opinions when you're organizing the intelligence. It tends to, people that are pushing for operations want results. They want certain opinions. And anyway, the five-star movement, okay, that Bernini, who recently made this pronouncement in the Italian parliament, okay, is a political parliament in Italy. The five-star movement is launched by Beppe Grillo, a popular activist, comedian, and blogger, and a web strategist on the 4th of October, 2009. The party is populist, anti-corruption, it's environmentalist, and partially Eurosceptic. Now, Eurosceptic means that they're not for this Euro Union, the European Union, the EU. So, and it also advocates participatory democracy, direct democracy, e-democracy, free access to the internet, the principles of zero-cost politics, and degrowth. The five-star movement's program also contains elements of right-wing populism and American-style libertarianism. The party members stress that the five-star movement is not a party but a movement, and it may not be included in the traditional left-right paradigm. See, this is getting more sophisticated, folks. We're breaking out of the left-right false paradigm like old Alex Jones has said for years. And I think, Alex, thank you. You coined that term for us. The five stars are referenced to five key issues: public water, sustainable transport, development, connectivity, and environmentalism. Okay. So anyway, Movimento. The symbol is a red circle, and inside is a white field. At the top is Movimento, in Italian, and with five stars in there. And I guess they stand for the reference to water, good water, sustainable transport, development, connectivity, and environmentalism. Okay, so that's where they get the five stars. So he's recently made a pronouncement that, hey, 9/11 was an inside job. So, I mean, things are happening. The public on this Syrian thing surprised many. Maybe that's part of this waking up process. We'll see what Ray McGovern has to say about that later. But that could very well be the dynamics here, that people are beginning to say, uh-oh, we got it, we got to wake up here. Oh, the ice caps, the North Pole ice caps are already iced over. The North Passage is closed earlier than it normally is. There's been, from year to year, an increase in 60% of the North Polar ice caps icing. So, and there's been more ice in the south too, in the Antarctic. So we've got the growth, the warm, you know, global warming people, they're saying their excuse now, okay, is, hey, it's a pause. See, it's a pause. Yeah, okay, it's a pause. But I mean, the ice cap's growing that much in 1 year, it's more than a pause, isn't it? And so we've got to see that. Donald Gibson out of New York, he's always said that environmentalism is about political control. So the term environmentalism on a general basis is that. Now, let's get back to some secret society insights here. Let's talk about Le Cercle, okay? And Le Cercle is interesting, okay? Because it is at the top, if not the top, of one of the largest, at the group, at the highest level. Let's put it this way. It actually was created in the 50s, okay? There were predecessor-type groups that came out of, basically, out of France, okay? And it has functioned. It was originally called the Pinay Circle. named after its family founder, Antoine Panay, premier of France in 1951. Known now more simply as Le Cercle, it is recognized as a more clandestine sister organization to the already very secretive Bilderberg Group. And this group is a hands-on. The Cercle is a hands-on. The Bilderberg Group is more of a policy-setting and goal-setting type of organization. Le Cercle, from everyone's viewpoint of this, is more of a hands-on, okay? Both of these groups, they share a membership. Kissinger is not only a member of the Bilderberg, but also Le Cercle. Brzezinski and David Rockefeller. David Rockefeller, the story goes, was forced by his directorship of Chase Manhattan Bank to withdraw from Le Cercle a number of years ago. But these people are all tied to the Foreign Relations Council, Foreign Relations, the Trilaterals, and the Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Studies. And anyway, it goes on and on. But what is very interesting about this is the latest chairman that I was able to get was Lord Lamont, okay? And he was chairman up through 2008. As of now, there's limited information on Le Cercle. You're not going to find much about Le Cercle because it is high level and is very secret, okay? So that's why on the Internet itself or anywhere else, there's very limited information. And that's why I'm still looking for the current chairman. When you're talking about who was the past chairman, that is interesting. Because Lord Lamont, okay, is still, and he was chairman recently of the Le Cercle, okay? And when you hear what he's tied to, you begin to understand that it's not just Catholics against Masons or Masons against Catholics. Okay, here we go. Norman Stuart Hugson Lamont, Baron Lamont of Lerwick. Okay, he was born the 8th on the 8th of May, 1942. He's a British politician, former Conservative MP for Kingston upon the Thames. He's best known for his period serving as Chancellor of the Exchequer from 1990 to 1993. He was created a life peer in 1998, it says here on this. Okay, he's also past chairman of Le Cercle, okay? And he had his earlier career within M. Rothschild & Sons Investment Bank, and became director of Rothschild Asset Management. Currently, in addition to his role as a working peer, he's a director of and a consultant to various companies in the financial sector. He is director of the hedge fund company RAB Capital, Bali Corporations. He's advisor to Roch Property Group. He's also director of a number of investment funds and so forth, okay? And he's a very powerful man. So when you see someone that was chairman of Le Cercle, and Le Cercle is actually, from descriptions of it, okay, it can be described as a Catholic-based group, okay? And it's got certain goals to reinstitute the Holy Roman Empire is one, okay? But it's also got interlocking with all kinds of intelligence people and interlocking types of relationships, okay? So it's very, very powerful, and it's something for us to continue. There have been articles over the years that have come out, but there's not just a whole lot of information on Le Cercle, because it is very secret still. And, I mean, some of the, you know what I mean, kings and queens or members and like this, I mean, you're going to find a tremendous, you know what I mean, membership there of very, very powerful people. And their goals are very, very hidden and sinister, and they're not easy to get to, see, to understand. This system is so big and humongous that it is not easy to understand and to fathom. That's why it is very difficult to establish a very objective view of this whole system. See, it's compartmentalized to a large extent, where people can only see a certain part of it. They can't see very much of it, and in doing that, they've closed off insights that you would have if you could see a much larger section of it. We believe that the interconnection between Le Cercle and the Gladio network was the stay behind anti-communist military set up by NATO. There's evidence in research by many hands that they had relationships with those Gladio networks. And we talked about the Gladio networks before. And those were actually created to continue to provide tension within these nation states in Europe, and then use that tension and focus it on some very radical socialist communist groups, and using them as scapegoats, and that would affect somewhat the public's fears and so forth, and then it would make the government officials heroes for protecting, see, the average working man in those countries. We've saved you from this terrible monster, see, from the Red Brigade in Italy and other things, see, the Weiner-Mannhof group in Germany, see. But they're ingenious, and they're very sinister, and Le Cercle, it looks like it's really one of the top groups. But it's Catholic-based, and also, when you look at the Knights of Malta, which is also, they had to withdraw after Napoleon pressured them on an attack on the Isle of Malta. They went ahead and negotiated a peace with Napoleon and withdrew from Malta to Italy, to Rome. And there today they have two sites in Rome, the Knights of Malta do. And also almost every, I can't say everyone, but almost every CIA director has eventually become a Knight of Malta. So you see how powerful, and the Knight of Malta is Catholic-based in Rome. You've got the Vatican in Rome. Both the Vatican and the Knight of Malta issue their own passports. So they're states within, they're considered to be states, nation states, so to speak. And so they do issue their own passports, the Knights of Malta and the Vatican, and they travel on those passports. So when you begin to see that, you say, what, you know? And you begin to see Lamont, Laura DeMont there, is a former, close advisor, director of all these different hedge funds for all the Rothschild interest. And then you say, well, the Rothschilds, aren't they from a Zionist-type group, you know, the Rothschild Zionist group? Well, I mean, but then they've got this director here that was, you know what I mean? They're all working together, folks. Hey, wake up and smell the roses out there, and you'll begin to see that they don't care. The ideas are just mechanisms to mesmerize the lower-level thinkers. They're actually tend towards more of a satanic type of dynamic that anything goes, that they do is warranted. There are no rules and laws that they have to conform to. And so, and that's what Satanism actually is. That idea of Satanism is that these people can do anything that they want. There's no rules and regulations to restrain them. And thus, they use any and every idea against the people professing those differing ideas and worldviews. So if you have if you're predisposed to a worldview, they figured out what that worldview is a long time ago, and they'll just feed you, food for thought, see? And then through that food for thought, they'll just lead you down the primrose path. And they'll think of you as an idiot, even a well-educated one at that. The intellectual problem is always there. The intellectual argument, the confluencing of ideas, the complexity of very deep systems and systems of thought. This is where these people dwell within, and they're masters of mind control and systems of thinking. And these systems of thinking are used in the end to subdue us and to control us and not to treat us right. We must awaken to this. We must come out of this. And the way to do it is, we've said it before, is forgiveness. We've got the legal standing. There's still a lot of problems with Eric Holder concerning this Fast and Furious. Okay, they're still stonewalling on that. Their legal stalling continues in the Eric Holder Fast and Furious contempt, a decision expected soon by legal scholars in the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform civil contempt case against Attorney General Eric Holder for his failure to submit subpoenaed records related to the Operation Fast and Furious gunwalking scandal. Okay, and Fox News was reporting that yesterday, which would be, yesterday's Friday. Day before yesterday is when they reported that. The documents sought relate to communications between the White House, the Department of Justice, as well as internal communications among senior Department of Justice officials, and center around a February 4, 2011 letter written by then Assistant U.S. Attorney General Ronald Weich, who told Senate Judiciary Committee ranking member Chuck Grassley the allegation that ATF sanctioned or otherwise knowingly allowed the sale of assault weapons to straw purchasers who then transported them to Mexico. Okay. Anyway, it's got to be forced. They're going to have to force them out of these articles, I mean these documents and so forth, but they've been hiding them for a long time here, and it's not totally likely that they're gonna succeed. That's what Obama and them have been good at, and all of these different politicians have been good at that over the years of doing the very same thing of just delaying and stonewalling and denying, you know what I mean, requests for this document and that document and so forth. Anyway, we want you to go to the RaymondMcGovern.com site, www.RaymondMcGovern.com, Ray McGovern, RayMcGovern.com, and then follow him and us in our conversation that's coming up this next hour. And Shimon Peres, let me make a note here. He said that no matter who did the event in August, that we still need to go in and get the chemical weapons. Well, I guess the Russians and Americans are, you know what I mean, pursuing that now. And then we've got all kinds of people that have testified before Congress, Clapper and all of them, and they've been very loose with the truth. So that's a continuous battle all the time. Well, we're coming to the end of the program, and we want to thank each and every one of you out there. You know, through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And if we can only learn how to forgive one another and start doing that, it's going to be a whole different world. Anyway, we're going to be closing down here in just a second and be out of here. We want to thank you for listening. And hang in there and don't switch that dial. And upcoming is Ray McGovern from Virginia. He's a stand-up guy. He has a lot to say. And we'll just have to let him unfold. He's going to tell us a little bit about his past life, too, about his past career, his early career. We're going to touch some on Iraq and get into some of those problems over there, too. And he's not just a Republican or Democrat. He's a truth man. So we're going to see what he has to say about the truth. And I know he stands on the truth and he stands up for the truth. And this man is something else. A good guy, good American. So hang in there. We're going to be moving out in just a few seconds here. But anyway, don't switch your dial and stay in there, and we'll be right back. We're going to take a brief break at the top of the hour. Thank you for listening.